Hey guys, this is Nikhil.
And this is Nick.
And welcome back to Impromatonauts.
Episode number 15, coming at you 1 week later.
Just chugging along, aren't we?
We are clicking along this week. It's been rather busy. Everything just kind of came to a head all at once. But I was talking to a friend yesterday and remarking that it was good that the week was over, right? But all the things I was supposed to do this week were kind of piling up, so I was actually wishing for two or three more days.
I know how that goes. That's why you spend your weekend working.
That's true, although I don't think that's necessarily the most healthy way to approach it.
No, it's not. But I've kind of had a similar week myself where actually what I've been trying this week is just stopping working. You know, at like 9 p.m., I just stop and go to bed, and I get up early again. That's been working out just fine for me. I found more productive than working late into the night. And this is funny because in my undergrad, I had a professor named Dr. Korf, and he taught me, or he advised me, don't code past midnight because you're going to start making lots of mistakes.
Yep.
And you're going to write this crappy code, and the next day you're going to spend more time like fixing your mistakes than you're going to be doing productive stuff. So don't code past midnight. I never took his word for it, but you know, I think now I'm starting to heed that advice.
It's true. I know I've had a couple of projects in the last couple of weeks where I tend to work a little bit later into the evening, but yeah, I noticed that there you hit that wall, right? And then all of a sudden everything like you're dropping periods and semicolons and labeling something with as you know loads instead of load or something like that. Yeah, I've noticed that happens definitely. So
there's a good book my girlfriend's parents actually bought me called Brain Rules, and this book, it's by a guy named John Medina. He's a professor at UW here, and I think he's in the bioengineering department, but traditionally, like, he was trained in psychology, so he has that lens of a psychologist, and he has this book of a bunch of rules that he says have been found in journals and rigorously tested, and if you implement them in your life, it's going to make your life better. So the first rule is exercise, and how exercise helps you think better. It helps you, you know, so if you're stuck on code or stuck wherever, if you just at that moment in time, just take a nap or better yet, go for a run, a 30-minute run, you refresh your mind to the point where it's like you started fresh again.
Interesting.
So I've started to do that and it has helped. I sort of feel myself getting more energy. And even though I quit coding at, you know, 9 or whatever, it's still, you know, if I hit a wall at 4 p.m., I go for a run, come right back, and I get more productive before dinner. So
cool.
It's fun to try.
Yeah. So what else have you been picking up from this book?
Well, besides naps, and you know what? I tend to take notes on all the stuff that I read. So I have an app called Day One, which is supposed to be a diary app, but I actually repurposed it for like my book notes app. And I'm going to pull up what I've written down so far. He actually has, at the end of every chapter, a nice summary about what you should and shouldn't do. So if you can give me a second, I'm going to pull that up right now. I have it started here somewhere. And here we are, Brain Rules book. So the second he has – so I mean
– Well, that's a pretty app. I don't think I've ever seen it before. It's very smooth.
Yeah, it's supposed to be. I mean, I think it does cost money. It's not free, but it's, you know, not much, and it's worth the buy. He talks about how to. So other stuff that he talks about is how, as a lecturer, he knows that people won't pay attention to boring things. So he developed this way through literature to make his lectures more interesting by buying, quote unquote, people's attention for about 10-minute time spans.
Interesting.
So when he do a presentation, he does have the material. And he does do, you know, what you would consider a normal lecture, but every 10 minutes in, he would interject something interesting, like maybe a meme from Reddit or something just off the wall. So everyone is paying attention again, and they can't tell when he will or won't interject anything of that nature. So that's kind of interesting as well. He talks about emotional arousal. He has a pretty cool perspective.
Emotional arousal.
Yeah. So that's how you – so when you're going to do a lecture, if you tell a story that gets people – that touches people emotionally, they're much more likely to pay attention.
Oh, yeah.
And people have a spotlight. So, I mean, what this means is he harps on the idea that you should not multitask ever, ever, ever. Don't multitask. We're not built for it. even biologically, evolutionarily, we just should not be doing it. What we are amazing at, though, is single tasking, like being focused on one task and being creative in that task. So that is what we should be doing. And if anything, we could parallelize that, but we should never be multitasking. And for some reason, businesses like multitaskers, but really they should like single taskers.
Yeah. So this is interesting. That idea of the single task goes back to, there's a book from the 70s, I think, called Peopleware.
Mm-hmm.
It was, so this book came out of a couple of guys that either worked for IBM or were managed consultants with IBM. And they wrote this book. It's called Managing Projects and Teams. And it was so influential that, in the early days of Microsoft, everybody got a copy. There were just, boxes of this books everywhere. First hired, you got a copy of Peopleware. And what it is, it's actually, back in the day, industrial. So not totally, not scientific studies, but industrial, research studies on how people worked and, operated within areas and stuff. And one of the things that they found was especially when you're working with these term knowledge workers, right? They have to be single source, and they have to be distraction free and get into that quote unquote zone. So the things that they advocated for were offices. Everybody gets an office with a closing door, even though that actually their primary thing was you assemble people into their groups, you designate them a workspace, and you let them configure it however they want. And you either give them a budget or you give them resources and stuff like that. But
that sounds very government.
No. Because the difference is that within their workspace, they have total ownership of it. If they want to put all the desks in the middle, then they can put all the desks in the middle where everybody's sitting facing each other. Like those SF lofts that look very much like the factories out of the Industrial Revolution in England.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to do that, fine. They get to do that. However, if they want to put plants in their office, if they want to, they can pick out their chairs and do all this stuff. So you allocate them their own little, not fiefdoms, but their own area, which they take ownership in and pride in and stuff like that. And you kind of let them go a little bit self-select. But the other thing is that you let people work in distraction-free areas. And they do address the issue of collaboration and things like that. So you want people to have freedom to move in and out of areas and come get help. Realizing the fact that people need to be, when they need to work, they need to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so really what they're advocating, if you ever go to the Microsoft campus, everybody has an office. Everybody. Some of the offices don't have windows, but everybody has this office that we're sitting in here right now where there's no windows except right by the door. But everybody has an office like this. And
interesting.
And I actually, for me, I work better in that type of thing where I can sit down and focus and have controlled access to people.
I actually don't. I feel so when I was working at Illumina, we had a very different setup. It was the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. It was they weren't quite cubicle farms, but they were close.
Mm-hmm.
And they would group people who worked together close to each other. And we'd constantly be getting up and talking to each other and going over to somebody else's desk and collaborating. And sometimes we'd get off task, go, hey, let's go to lunch or let's get a coffee break. And we'd talk about other stuff. But at the same time, it was nice to be very close to each other and to get up and walk around, it kind of helped, in a sense, refresh my mind. And also, yes, it would be disruptive to my workflow, but it would also give me something new to work with, new information. So I walk over to marketing, learn something new that I didn't know before, and I go, oh my God, what I'm doing, it has to be, accommodating to what they're doing. So we had this sense of this kind of integration in a way.
Yeah.
We weren't isolated in silos.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my point is that there is that risk of if you're going to be working really hard in an office by yourself, you could walk down this rabbit hole and go really deep into something that might not be relevant or might not have any context in terms of the company. So I think they were very, very afraid of that, the management was. So
I think it's a challenge is to strike this balance. I worked in one place where it was cubicle farms, but they were the full height cubicles,
mm-hmm.
with 3.5 walls, right? And so that actually, I really liked that, especially in the group that I was in, where it was very collaborative. You could go up and wander over and ask questions and stuff. But this created a sense of this is my own space. I feel a little bit isolated, appropriately isolated, where I can just kind of put my head down and work. And there's that creates like a physical and a mental boundary that, and I think boundaries are like really good and healthy, right? If it's like, okay, you want something that enables you to say, I'm focused, please don't bother me. But okay, now I'm just kind of like working on fiddly stuff or whatever. So let's like, yeah, let's feel free to get up. If you have like questions, come ask, I'm going to come ask you, like that type of stuff. And it's hard to strike that balance. And I think, so I like the idea of either those types of cubes or like offices with open doors kinds of things. Like, okay, door shut, I'm in the zone, don't mess with me, I need like an hour or two. But then, you know, opening the door, you can like come in and out and let's be collaborative and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So Bell Labs back in the day used to have a rule where nobody could turn down help or turn down requests for help.
What do you mean?
So like that if somebody came and had a question, like, so this is the thing. So you'd have these folks in here who like they had at one time there were like dozens of Nobel Prize winners in the office, right? So you as like a junior engineer, right, would come in and you'd like come to your manager and be like, I have a question about this. They'd say, oh, well, John over there is he won the Nobel in that. So go ask him. He's the expert. And you'd walk over, and if you asked John for help, he had to help you. He couldn't like farm you off or like turn you away. He had to help you with what you were working on. Now, not like, and there were some limits on that. If like, it's not like he got get dragged into your project or whatever. But if you had a question or needed an explanation or assistance with something, he had to help you.
That is awesome. That's yeah. A great rule.
And so that was the thing. They're saying like it didn't matter if you were a junior engineer or a program director or anything like that. It was you moved in. You could just move in and you'd move up and ask help.
You know, personally,
I love that. I don't know how you do that really well, but I love that.
I do like it. I like it a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't really experience being turned down for help until mm-hmm. I came back to grad school, where everyone's just so busy. They're just like, I don't have time for this right now. I'm spread thin across four projects, and they're all, you know, like these big grants, and I can't mess these up. So go talk to somebody else right now, and I'll help you when I can, but I just don't have the bandwidth. Like, I would never get that explanation or excuse, I call it. So it's something that is interesting to figure out how to deal with. I haven't quite found a way to do it myself, but if we had a rule like that, that would be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how – again, all of these things are like – they're great in theory and all that stuff, but I don't know how you do them in the real world, quote unquote. But because those are real constraints, right? They, people have lots of stuff to do. Yesterday I was trying to work on a project and some folks came in and were socializing and chatting, and I was like trying to engage and be friends. I wanted to talk with them, but I'm also trying to like run some tests and things. I'm like kind of like torn between those two worlds, and you could get kind of frustrated. It's like, okay, we need boundaries here.
That's why I put the headphones on, because I work in kind of an open space cubicle, right? Mm-hmm. So if I have the headphones on, people typically know he's trying to focus, don't bug him, unless it's important.
Yeah.
And then they'll tap me on the shoulder and, you know, they get my attention, and then I have no problem taking my headphones off and addressing whatever needs to be addressed. But I think having the headphones is like the unofficial way around here to basically say, I'm busy.
Yeah. You know, the other thing is, so a couple of the folks here, their cube mate will do like 45-minute sprints or an hour sprint. So they just put their headphones on, they work for an hour, and then they come back and they like chat and engage and do all that stuff. Then go back for another 45
minutes.
That's
healthy, kinda, yeah.
Yeah, and so that way, 45 minutes, you're focused, which is about as long as you can really focus on something.
According to psych studies, yes. Right?
So that type of stuff, like finding those bounds, but finding the things that work for you. But I think especially espousing a culture of, we're collaborative, but we also provide this space where it's like when you're in, however, whatever in the zone means, or however that social signal is, don't bug them and let them go and do their thing and then come back out. So,
you know, I try and get here early, like early in the morning, mm-hmm. between anywhere between 6 a.m. Believe it or not, this place does open at 6 a.m.
I don't believe that 6 a.m. is a real thing.
Oh, well, you know what? Between 6 a.m. and noon, it's amazing how much stuff you can get done because no one's here. And for some reason, grad students don't get up until like noon anyway. So it's nice to have this chunk of time. This is like something my uncle taught me. Do stuff when nobody else does it. So do your laundry on a Friday night, like before you go out partying, because no one's going to do their laundry on Friday night before they go out partying. And you're going to have this entire laundry space to yourself. Or the same thing with the computer lab. If you're working on a computer lab-based, you know, class, you can go in during a time when nobody else goes in, and you can have the entire lab to yourself.
Yeah.
And you can do whatever you want. So in that same way, I get in early because nobody gets in here early.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and I do the opposite. I come in in the evening. So
right, because nobody stays that late.
Nobody stays that late, and and you get to kind of relax it. So I like that. So one last thing before we move on, have you read Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman?
I have read that book. I don't recall much of it, which is probably a bad sign.
Yeah, so I haven't read it yet. I got a copy of it.
Oh, wait, can I take a quick guess? Yes. Okay, there's two types of thinking.
Yes.
One type of thinking is the slow type of thinking. The other type of thinking is the fast type of thinking.
That's correct.
The fast type of thinking is more along the lines of feeling quickly and just kind of using your gut. And the slow one is a bit more objective and like taking a step back and taking like a 10,000 foot view about what could be happening.
Yeah, I think he phrases it more in deliberative and analytical versus intuitive and like quick decision making or something. I can't remember exactly how he. So I haven't read the book either. I haven't read the book. I have a copy of it and I loaned it out and haven't gotten it back. But that's another one where it's looking at when he either won the Nobel for this or other work like this. So he's very, very good. And so he kind of looks at the different ways in which we make decisions and then splitting that up to saying what decisions can we just kind of make and trust our rapid instinct and then or our fast thinking, and then what do we need to move back and like say, okay, I need to sit and think on this for a day or two. Not just because I don't know the answer. Maybe I do know the answer or I think I know the answer, but because the type of thinking that requires the type of answer that's required for this question is the type that is like experience, like over time, and is that slow type of thinking. So, I think it's interesting. There's been a lot of work on trying to build tested, validated assumptions and ideas upon which we can make this. We can help make decisions by learning how our brains work,
mm-hmm.
And that's in a sense what this Peopleware book did. It was how do people actually work in offices and in workspaces and in groups and teams. And how can we're going to test this and figure it out. Now, the studies, it'd be interesting to see the studies updated because I think the book came out in the 60s or 70s. And so people and modes and cultures have shifted over time. But yeah, I really appreciate that approach of saying, like, let's actually go and dig down and look and see how people respond and work.
Mm-hmm.
So. Well, continuing on this theme, there was an article that came up on, remember, was it last time we talked about Spritz?
Mm-hmm.
About the new method of reading by you focus on one area and they show the word to you over time as you go along. So there was an article that came out on Ars Technica that was a paper, I believe the paper was in Nature or PLOS ONE or something like that. Some researchers at UC San Diego looked at it and said, something smells fishy about this. And so they did a study, a really quick study on 20 college students or something, at 40 college students at UCSD, came out in Psychological Science just recently. And this is an initial, and they do make the claim that this is an initial study on, like, look at this. So they did it rapidly and quickly to generate some information. And so we have these things called saccades, which is like the cadence at which our eyes move back and forth between words and objects. And so one of the things that they looked at and discovered, or they had this hunch that they were able to kind of work off of, was that we don't just move forward, we move back and forth over a sentence, which is part of our brain processing and contextualizing what we're reading. So as we're going along, it's firming up our understanding of what we also just read. And so you kind of like go back and clarify your assumptions and ideas. And so one of the problems with Spritz is that it's continuously forward motion.
Right.
So you have no ability to go back and work over something and pick it up again. So they said under normal circumstances, where they would take a sentence and then they would black out portions of it. Comprehension of ambiguous sentence. How would they? I just want to see exactly what they blacked out here.
Well, this is an interesting study. But I think in a sense, you know, I always think of things in terms of trade-offs. And if you're going to read quickly, I would imagine that you're trading off comprehension. But the idea behind Spritz was that you get to retain your comprehension as you read quickly. So that's why it was kind of making a lot of waves on the internet here.
Right. Well, and their science was the fact of not just reading quickly, like skipping words, but taking away the times in which our eyes move between words, right? So it's just taking away the physical process. Okay, here we go. Sorry. Okay, I found it. So what they did was they would show a sentence and you would kind of they would scroll along. They used eye tracking software to keep an eye on where your eyes were. And they said so they had two sentences. One where the meaning was ambiguous and another where the subject of the sentence can only be determined based on words that appeared about 2/3 of the way through the sentence. For an example, while the man drank the water that was clear and cold overflowed from the toilet.
Wait, what?
Wow, okay. So once the sentence was read, they were given a question that determined their comprehension of the sentence. It said, even under normal circumstances, comprehension of the ambiguous sentence was below 70%. But when previously read words were blocked out, the comprehension dropped even further. So as they dropped words, so as you would read, they would black out words, your comprehension of the sentence just, like, plummeted. And so the point is, like, when you have sentences that aren't immediately straightforward or immediately clear, you go back to help refine and clear up what you've been looking at. And those are termed regressions, where your eyes move backwards over a page. That's part of our natural comprehension process.
Right. I think we talked about this. Either you or I brought it up a few weeks ago when we first talked about Spritz and, you know, where it would be great and where it wouldn't be great. And I think the consensus we came to was that, it, you know, Spritz is great for, you know, storybooks or easily read material, but it's terrible for scientific papers or...
Not even scientific papers. Anything with any, like, these are ambiguous sentences, right? So, I mean, one only has to read a couple novels to realize, like, oh my gosh, these writers are writing really densely and really complexly. And so you need to have that ability to keep going.
You might not
to regress be able over to the read word
War and Peace through Spritz, but
yeah.
I would imagine, you know, like the BFG or something like at the sixth grade reading level would be quick and easy. Yeah.
That would be interesting, is to take this same study and to classify like a bunch of material by either reading level or like complexity or something. So an article on BuzzFeed it's something off like BuzzFeed or TMZ where it's like, and this person went here, then this person did this, and then they did this, and then Hello Cats, like something like that, versus then even taking a step up, like reading an Economist article or something from The Atlantic.
Exactly. That would be more, I mean, this is kind of saying something obvious. Mm-hmm. And if they had broken it down into...
But I think it's saying something obvious because I think some points we understand it, at least anecdotally. But the other thing is, how do you classify what complex material is?
Oh, well, they actually have a scale with which you can take a piece of writing and classify it as, this is at a 12th grade reading level, this is at a 10th grade reading level, so on and so forth. So had they done a more stratified study...
But that is built on vocabulary, and that's built on sentence length. Not necessarily like grammatical complexity. So this test sentence they have here, while the man drank the water that was clear and cold overflowed from the toilet. I really don't know what that sentence means.
Right.
But there's nothing complicated in that sentence. It's simple words. It's not super long. So that might get classified as like a sixth grade level, but that's a complex sentence I'm going to have to read over and over again.
That looks like it's a terrible sentence.
It kind of is a terrible sentence. I think that's the point. Now, the other thing is that they are asking people, like, they're now asking them sentences about or questions about that sentence.
Uh-huh.
How many people are reading books and, like, you're zipping through this on Spritz and you don't even know that you didn't comprehend it?
What it's showing us here is that really an ambiguous sentence had a certain level of comprehension without Spritz, and when put into Spritz, because you're flying through it, you had an even lower level.
No, they didn't do it with speed. All they did was remove the ability to regress. They removed the ability to go backwards. This has nothing to do with speed.
We're going backwards because there's no punctuation in the sentence here. While the man drank the water that was clear and cold, overflowed from the toilet. I don't know if the water overflowed from the toilet before or after he drank it. But it's happening while he drank it. That's such, I don't know. It's a weird sentence.
It is a weird sentence, but we read weird sentences all the time. And their point is they didn't use spritz. All they did was use a traditional, like, they showed sentences and then, like, I don't know exactly how they did it. But then they would, like, block out the words. Like, they would remove your ability to go backwards. Like, as you, like, they would either scroll a sentence or something and then they would black out the words behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Or they would reveal it and black it out. So that way you could only look at either the word that you were on or the words going forward using like eye tracking software, I think. So you couldn't, so there was no ability. So it has nothing to do with speed. All it had to do was the ability to naturally move in a cadence across a page.
I think any professor of writing can tell you that a poorly written sentence is hard to comprehend.
But it's not even, there's not even poorly written. So there are just dense sentences, but right?
This isn't dense.
I mean, if
or complicated. It's just poorly punctuated.
But this is just an example. It's not the sentence, but an example of the sentence, right? So, or sentences that are ambiguous, right? Like I was reading an Indonesian author the other week, and he writes very Eastern, and some of the stuff I had to go back over and over again to try and like pick it up. Or you read Tolstoy, you read David Foster Wallace. These are like dense, like tones. Like,
Waldo Emerson. Yeah.
Like those are not poor sentences, nor are they crappy sentences. They're just dense, and but they're complicated. And it's difficult. It's difficult to extract those. You kind of process them. And so their point is that spritz is fine, except that if you don't understand the sentence immediately, you're not like going to pick it up.
Well, spritz is great for situations where an author is writing the same way they typically speak.
That could probably be like as well.
It would be great for transcripts, basically. Instead of listening to an ebook or listening to a transcript of a lecture, if you spritz through it, that's where the value is, because it's something that somebody has said from their mouth. And that's been transcribed onto.
But how much do you actually process as a professor is speaking it? How much are you actually like retaining? I mean, that's the whole point, is it's like if you are able to, because you don't have the ability to go backwards, right? So you're just kind of keeping along with them.
Right. And they take that into account, which is why they repeat things, or which is why they, like, their lectures are structured.
That's true. But any good editor is going to chop out like most of the superfluous stuff.
Right, but this is why you might not want to do it, and this might not be good for storybooks or scientific documents, but it's great for lectures or transcripts, where it's just like a
transcripts that might be
a complete carbon copy of what somebody else has said.
Transcripts might be interesting. I could see that. So if there's additional information embedded, if there's redundancy in the information,
right? If there's a 2-hour lecture and you can get through, you can spritz through it in a half hour. Wonderful.
Yeah. Okay. That'd be interesting. If the material is repeated enough that the comprehension is taken over the bulk of the document as opposed to each individual sentence.
But it has to take an oratory structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now that makes sense. I think what's interesting, I think this paper, one, is the groundwork for some other interesting things. But there's also, again, as I mentioned earlier, the danger of reading something and thinking that you understand it and realizing that like your comprehension level is like 3%.
I think this is just too academic. It's just trying to disprove something or trying to get, I don't know.
I think
it's a cry for attention. I think what they should do is focus on, we all know that there's going to be situations where this app is not going to be great. That's a given. But what they should do is look for, like I just mentioned, the oratory type transcript.
I think that this paper is necessary to look at it, because I think there's going to be lots of people that are going to say, oh my gosh, I can just like grab War and Peace and I can spritz through it in 2 hours, right? And you look at it and you say, no. Like, I can tell you, have you read that book? With the way that this app is talking about, or the way that they're talking about and the comprehension method they're talking about, you will not understand almost anything from War and Peace.
Well, they'll learn that very quickly in a matter of 2 hours.
Will they? Or will they just like process it? You're just like, I didn't realize I didn't get that, right? It's like, you don't know what you don't know until somebody points it out to you. Like, you're like, oh, I thought I knew this. Oh, I thought I understood it. Then somebody brings it up, you're like, we're not even talking about the same thing. So I remember, so I took a law class in August. It was my first like real, like, it's the first real law class. Like, out of a case book, it was just me and a bunch of, I got special provisions, me and a bunch of JDs, like, and LLMs. And I read the first set of cases. And I walked in and went into the lecture and sat down. They started talking. And I just was like, and my first thought was, we didn't read the same thing, but we did. I read the cases, right? And I read through them, I highlighted them, and did all this stuff, and it was so different. And they were just processing on a totally different level that I just was not comprehending it. And I didn't know that. I walked in and I thought, I was like, okay, I know what I'm doing. I've got this. Like, I know, like, I knew the facts of the case. I knew, like, I looked up beforehand, like, how to read a case, a legal case, because it's so different than a scientific paper. And so I looked it up and, like, I went through it and I thought I knew what I was doing, but I didn't.
Well, what's so different about it?
The structure, it takes much more of a narrative structure. There's a lot of different terminology. So you have plaintiff's respondent. You have the way that it goes through. So each court's a little bit different. When you read a scientific paper, right, you read the abstract, then you read the first few cases and stuff. You read the abstract, then you immediately skim for the plus minus signs, right? Because you're looking for the results with the error bounds and things. You don't have those. You don't have any of the visual cues to, like, pick up. There's no charts or graphs, so it's hard to pick up the overall gist. So you kind of have to start going through it. And then depending on what you're trying to do, can you just kind of go to the holding? Do you need the background or the facts and things like that? If there's a precedent that's been laid down, you need to, like, that's, like, going to be in a certain section. And so you just read it differently than you do with a normal and it's kind of hard to explain. It's just a different way of reading. It's not like totally foreign, like, but you have to learn the terminology and the, and just kind of the structure and stuff. And it's also just a different body of knowledge that you have to, like, switch into your brain. And it took me the first 3 weeks to get to the point where when we were discussing it in class that I was tracking. It's like, yep, I caught that. Yep, I saw that. Yeah, I was thinking about that. But I didn't know that until it was presented to me.
Interesting.
And I genuinely thought that I knew what I was doing and knew what I was reading.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. And so I'm hesitant when I read things like this because there's so much, there's a difference between information and knowledge. And that's kind of what they talk about. There's difference from just, like, picking up, like, it taking, like, inputting words and extracting meaning.
Well, that's, I mean, when I read something, even a scientific paper, I always try and take a big paragraph and I try to summarize it in one word or one sentence. And that gives me, like, the main idea of what that paragraph is trying to say. And of course, there's going to be details in there that I'm going to be, sort of making notes about. But at the same time, I kind of know, okay, I have the structure. Here's four paragraphs in the background. The first one's about the history. The second one's about past work, so on and so forth. And I know where to look for information if I want to look for it. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And again, it goes back to that being able to flip back and forth to things and move at a different cadence that's not just all the way through. It's a difference between listening and hearing, right? Does your girlfriend ever, like, you're not listening to me. It's like, no. I hear what you're saying. She doesn't do that.
I'm a great listener.
Oh, gosh. I'm a terrible listener. So I always hear all the time, you're not listening to me. It's like, yes, I am. Like, I can repeat back what they're saying. Like, no, no, no. There's a difference to it. Oh, and the other thing, I always, like, people will be talking and I'm, like, looking away. Like, you're not listening to me. It's like, yes, I am. It's like, no, because listening is a process beyond just the intake of auditory information. You probably are. You are a good listener. I'm terrible. I score, like, have you ever done those, like, how good of a listener test that you are? Like, I always score, like, at the bottom.
It's funny. When my mom and I talk, we're always making eye contact. When my dad and I talk, we're always kind of looking away from each other.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when we do make eye contact, we know it's because this is some serious shit.
Yeah.
So it's just like, it's a lot more deliberate.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So this is an interesting paper and one that I'm glad that one of the things I like is that they took something that came out, they rapidly prototyped a study, did it, put it out there.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kudos That's to them for cool. doing that. Yeah. But at the same time, I feel like they could do so much more. They've just scratched the surface.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think that they addressed that in the paper of saying, here's what we'd like to do more. Well, let's move on. Can we move to this? What is this simple map reduce thing? Can you tell me about this?
Yeah, it was basically a blog post I found on the internet, and it's I like simple explanations, and this was a very, very simple explanation of what map reduce is. In fact, it may be so simple that it might even be wrong to a degree, but that's okay because I think for a lot of listeners out there who don't know what map reduce is, they're going to it's a word that you hear a lot, quite a lot. So it's great to get even a rudimentary understanding of what MapReduce does. So there was a paper published by Google on MapReduce and how cool it is and efficient it is. And the main idea is that with this process called MapReduce, you can do a lot of really heavy calculations over a distributed system and get the result very, very quickly. So when he or she explained MapReduce, he broke it down into a set of four steps. You're going to have the master, which is you, and you're going to be dishing out your job, splitting it up into and giving it to mappers. And these mappers are like your managers, micromanagers. And these managers they give their chunk of this big project to a grouper. So, and each one of these mappers has their own grouper. And then you have reducers who like take all the work that the groupers do, and then they reduce it down and consolidate it. And then they give it back to their master, to the mappers, and then the mappers give it back to you as the master. So in this way, it's like this tree structure where you have this big job and it's chunked out into little pieces. And if you think about it, instead of doing one really heavy job on one computer in serial, it's just parallelizing that same thing. So if you have an embarrassingly parallel job, it'll go very, very quickly. And in the era of cloud computing, this is like – it does seem like it's very, very rudimentary, but the fact that they were able to conceptualize it and turn it into not just a theory but like a tangible type of coding mechanism, people have that you can refer to and know what you're talking about. People have adopted MapReduce as like one of the de facto standard ways of dealing with cloud computing. Mm-hmm. So again, you have the master, that's you, and then you have these little managers that work under you called the mappers, and then they give their stuff to groupers, and then the groupers give their stuff to reducers, and the reducers give it back to the mappers, and the mappers give it back to you, the master, and you have all your like your big computational job done. So that is basically all I wanted to say about that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm browsing through this a little bit. First thing I noticed is I'm pretty sure that Yahoo was the one that did MapReduce.
Are you sure?
I think so. The guy who Hadoop, I believe, came out of Yahoo, which actually the guy came out of UW here.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Mm-hmm. I thought Hadoop came out of UW. I didn't know he came out of Yahoo.
Well, I think he wrote it while he was a computer grad student, and I think he wrote it while he was like interning at Yahoo. Mm-hmm. Or there was the guy who wrote it came from UW.
Hmm.
And so I believe he was working on it while he was here and then finished it at Yahoo. So Google very well may have done the MapReduce concept and then it was actually turned into something. But I know that like MapReduce as we know it, like Hadoop and all of its derivatives, that came out of Yahoo, which came out of UW. So, and now there's a new one that UW just came out with called Haloop.
Called what?
Haloop. Instead of Hadoop, it's Haloop, Haloop.
Uh-huh.
And basically it's what happens if you're chaining, if you have iterative computing processes that you have to do. So like PageRank and things are based off of not only this result but the previous one.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a modification, same kind of principle, but allows you to chain jobs together and it caches the information on the disk. Or not cache, not just on the disk, it keeps the information there and it keeps state so it can refer to the previous computational state.
Oh,
so that way you can feed into the next, you can chain steps together. So that way instead of going out, mapping the first step, reducing it, pulling it all back, mapping, reducing the second step, you can do these iterative chains of computing and stuff like that.
You know, one idea I've had is that I wish that people could actually take their computer, like the way it is, everything inside there, and then kind of make a virtual copy of it. And then have that file be small enough and virtualization engines be fast enough that you can send it. Say I have done a bunch of research and I have like a terminal file open and a bunch of files on my computer, like a big file structure. And I don't want to like package it up and make you install it. Just make an image of whatever I have, send it to you. You load it into your virtualization engine. You can play with whatever I'm seeing. And you can literally interact with my environment, like a copy of my environment.
Yeah.
And that hasn't been done yet. And that would be super cool.
Yeah, there's a couple of projects towards that one. It's called Docker,
mm-hmm.
which lets you basically takes a snapshot of system state packages and things like that, packages it all up and lets you move it to another kind of platform. So there are some things like that, but no, not nearly on the level that you're talking about. That would be really cool. Doesn't Python try to do that with like virtual environment, like virtual env?
Mm-hmm.
Of like you can just like package that up and send it with all the like the package information and stuff like that.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah.
No, that is really, yeah. Getting environments up and running is such a huge problem. It's really, really difficult, and there needs to be a better way to do that. So, and I've done a bunch of stuff with Hadoop, and Hadoop is, you have to make sure that on all your nodes and everything that you've got all the packages and all the file resource, the resource locators are lined up and all that stuff. Otherwise, it's just going to start. You're going to get these cascading failures.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's Java, you just get this nasty heap dump out on the other end. And you're like, ugh.
Kill me now.
I know, it's kind of awful. But so, yeah, no, MapReduce is something. MapReduce is a powerful concept. And I like the way that they're explaining it within, like, kind of, just really simple terms for you to start thinking, how can I break my job up?
It's really quite simple.
Yeah,
it's deceptively simple.
It is. But it's so incredibly powerful. I've been doing a bunch of stuff with GATK, mm-hmm. and they call Scatter Gather. It's their own version of MapReduce. But yeah, same thing.
Like, Scatter Gather.
That's what they call it, Scatter Gather. And so you either take all your BAM files, or you take a single BAM and you slice it all up and you fire it out to all the nodes, and then you pull it back out. The reason they call it Scatter Gather is because it basically, all it does is break it all up into a bunch of jobs. Whereas MapReduce will actually MapReduce will iterate on different. It's a little bit different. Scatter Gather is a lot more like brute force. It requires like an existing scheduling engine, and it just like smashes a whole bunch of jobs into Grid Engine and then pulls them all back.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit different on that end, but yeah.
It's funny because when you say scatter or gather, it kind of gives me this image of like shotgun sequencing.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm.
Which is like traditionally shotgun approaches have been like the standard in biology, and a lot of computer scientists scoff at it. Like there was a Tableau talk.
Yeah, yeah.
And I forget the guy's name, Pat Hanrahan, I think. He basically like was like, "Who does a shotgun approach here on anything?" And I raised my hand, and he kind of just like, "Are you just trolling me, or are you serious?"
He's trolling me.
Yeah. I could the look on his face was like,
"Troll,
you're kidding, right?" But no, that's the way that we think. It's not that it's wrong. It can be inefficient, but in terms of in biology, when you have a number of short sequences, that a number of them are highly repetitive, you have to kind of assemble them somehow.
Yeah.
And when your data is captured in a shotgun way, it's nice to use a shotgun approach to assemble them.
Yeah.
And people have been using graph-based methods now more recently to assemble these genomes, but and they've been working, but there probably are better ways to do it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think that's something maybe you can discover.
Yeah. But, the question is, what does efficiency mean? What does efficient mean? Does it mean that it's like computationally efficient that for every clock?
That's what he means.
Yeah, it's for every clock cycle you're doing the maximum amount of work. Does it mean that for the amount of resources you're paying for that you're like efficient and that it's not costing a lot? Or does efficiency mean that you can kick out a bunch of results either with minimal effort for you or quickly or rapidly? Like how much does it take? So graph databases are like really cool. They're also really complicated. They can be really complicated. Like building out this complicated data model to like figure out how to fit all this stuff together may be way less efficient than just throwing it into the cloud and burning on it for 2 hours and then pulling the results back.
Mm-hmm.
Like that idea of efficiency, you have to define by what you mean by efficient and like what your end result and end goals are.
I look at efficiency in like this big picture view, but a lot of people look at efficiency in terms of big O complexity or something like that.
Absolutely. Now, if I'm talking about, so some of the stuff that I'm, some of the processes that I'm trying to work on in genomics are running on big clusters for 50 or 60 hours. Efficiency means that if I can spend 40 hours, like figuring out a repeatable way to do that job in half the time or three quarters of the time, mm-hmm. that's efficiency. Because especially when you do this multiple times, you're immediately going to recover those costs, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm just trying to, like, I'm just trying to do some simple benchmarking for a presentation on Monday, I'm just shotgun up there, throw up some servers, glue them together, and run some quick benchmarks, just proof of concept sanity checking. It's not worth me, like, writing, scripting, and I'm just going to, like, do a bunch of, like, crappy bash scripts to, like, generate and, like pull the results out. I could build, a testing platform and do this, like, repeatable. Maybe I'll do that, like, replicate this in the future. But for now, efficiency is get results quickly. And get a bunch of variations on results and just throw an asterisk up there that said, I did this quickly. So, absolutely. All right. One more thing that I wanted to hit on. So this is a big year. Or sorry, do we have anything else you want to talk about on that before we move on?
Not really. So I bought this banana bread from downstairs.
Yeah.
It's delicious. I'm just chewing it and I'm just leaving Nick here hanging out to dry.
No, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure. I'm cool. I'm happy to keep blabbering. So this is a big anniversary this year. This year is the 50th anniversary of the basic programming language. I guess, right? 50 years. So I read a piece on this. So BASIC was written. It's actually kind of cool. It was written by two mathematicians at Dartmouth on a way to teach people how to, like, simply and easily program a computer. And they wanted to do it. And when they did it and they built it, and they were, like, building up the CS resources, one of the rules, and they're one of the first universities to do this, is that the computing center and the basic courses were open enrollment. Anybody could come in and do it. Whether you're an English major or a history major or math, physics, whatever, you had access to the computing resources.
We don't even have that at UW.
Not really, no. We have access controls and stuff here. But they did it from the beginning. They were saying that pretty quickly, like 70% of the students, like something like 40% of the students in like their basic programming classes were non like science or math majors.
Wow.
Which is kind of amazing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought, I don't know. Did you learn or write BASIC growing up?
No, not
you
once.
You did not? Wow.
I went straight to C and then from C to HTML and I kind of converged from those both. So like,
those are two extremes. Yeah. Right?
And I ended up with Python. So
interesting. So I started I think BASIC might have been the first language that I learned. It was. I got a book on BASIC in fifth grade from the school library, right? And started, I would sit.
School did you go to? Good God.
What?
They had a BASIC book in your school library?
They had like an introduction. They had four. In my elementary school, they had four books. They had one on BASIC, one on Pascal, one on COBOL, one on Fortran. And I read all of them. I would sit out in recess and read programming books. Yes, I was that kid. And BASIC was the one that I could do because it was installed on like on our home computer, right? So I could go back and I could write little BASIC programs. And it was really cool, right? And there's something, as you're reading and talking about this, what does it take to write a BASIC program? You know, it's like nothing. You just do it. There's no functions. There's no methods. There's no classes. There's no scopes or namespaces. You just start writing it, right?
And is BASIC, is that the same thing as Visual Basic?
So Visual Basic is an extension on BASIC. So it's similar but different. So one of the things about BASIC is that there's no true BASIC. It's all these variations and derivatives and stuff on it. And Visual Basic is Microsoft's kind of take. But they like glued on a bunch of like, it's Visual Basic's like object-oriented, right?
I don't know. I mean, I've written Excel sheets with macros in them.
Yeah, of course.
And pivot tables. And
yeah.
I've done this because sometimes when working with bioinformaticians or chemists or something like that, they don't know programming and they don't want to learn either because they're intimidated. They just don't want to spend the time to learn something that they're not going to use very much. So I've actually used Excel to build like Excel sheets of like analyses and data.
Yeah.
And written macros and given people functions. And they've used that. Now, I don't think that was Visual Basic, but I think maybe I was getting close.
There's Visual Basic. I think there's three types. There might only be two. There's Visual Basic, VisualBasic.net, and those two might be the same thing. Then there's VBA, which is Visual Basic for Applications, and those are all different. So BASIC has always, like, one of the big critiques against it is that it's really just scattered and fragmented. There's like all these different kinds, but yeah, I've written some macros in VBA, of course. I did some Visual Basic programming, like after I got bored writing little command line programs, I picked up the like one of those SAMs, like Teach Yourself VB in 24 Hours or something like that.
I love those books. It's like a weekend project. You just like pick up a book, you flip through it, and you're like, wow, I know this. I know Kung Fu.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome Matrix reference. So I did some of that kind of stuff as well. I never did a lot with VB. What I found is that what comes really naturally to me is algorithms like and systems programming. What comes really unnaturally to me is GUIs. Anytime you bolt a GUI onto something, I'm just like, it's it just, for some reason, I've just never been able to really fit that model into my brain.
I put that, for me, I had the same issue. And what I've done is, this is why web programming was so hard for me at first.
Yeah.
Because it's basically a GUI.
Yeah, but it's just like, it's just stacking stuff on top of itself, right?
Like, yes, but it's basically, you give people a limited interface to work with, to interact mm-hmm. with your functions. So look at it that way. Instead of, like, I put GUIs and web interfaces in the same box.
Yeah, that's myself as well, right? And I found that I love writing, like, APIs, and I love writing, like, systems applications and things. Like, I actually was really not a programmer until I was in college, about halfway through college, when I got a job writing as a database developer for an insurance company. And all of a sudden, I started writing stuff that was like writing giant, you know, functions and select queries and all this kind of stuff, and in T-SQL for Microsoft SQL Server, and just fell in love with it. Like, the fact that, one, I didn't have to deal with any GUIs, right? It was in fine space. It's like, all right, give me your input parameters, and I'm going to do all this awesome stuff in the background, right? And profile, like, I'm gonna build the execution plans. I'm going to go through, and I'm going to tweak, and I'm going to optimize and do all this stuff. But whenever you ran it, you got a result back, right? So it was immediate feedback, and I love that. And that's more difficult with other programs. But that's really what got me deep into programming. And I never – before that, I had just written a bunch of, like, one-off little side projects and stuff, But BASIC was what I started, was what got it all began, whenever it all began. And I still have some of the old books. I have, like, one of the old IBM, like, BASIC, like, reference manuals. Like, the ring bound, like, in a box, hardback, ring bound, right? Like, this thing is, and I will never get rid of it. I'm going to hold on to it forever because it's such a nostalgic piece.
That's a relic. Yeah, yes, you should hold on to that.
It's a relic, and it's really cool. And BASIC was the first time that I really... It's the first language that I ever programmed in. Then I went to VB. I wrote some C, Perl, and I don't think... No, I didn't do Perl. Did Python. PHP. Did some PHP and stuff. But yeah, never really... I was a hardware guy for years and years and years.
I'm looking for something. I remember...
The DoD books?
Yeah. I think there was... So,
the Orange Manual?
And like the big red book that won't fit in the shelf. I think it's a red book here. But there's a number of books that have been released, and that, you know, I think my dad actually has quite a lot of these somewhere. I don't know, it's interesting to look at, but I think those might be worth some money someday too.
Oh yeah, yeah, the old Rainbow series. Are they still producing them?
No, I don't think they are.
Okay, I don't remember. Anyways, yeah, so the question nowadays is we're teaching kids how to do all of, like, we're teaching kids, so many kids are programming stuff nowadays, and, like, they're teaching them in, like, Python, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, isn't that kind of the starter language that teach people how to write some basic, like, code or whatever?
Yeah, they are. People are starting, so there's, you know, if you're already a programmer, you don't want people to start with Python, you want them to start with C, and then learn Python, because that way they have the underlying fundamental structure to build Python on.
Okay, hold on. I think if you're teaching people how to be computer scientists or, like, quote unquote programmers, probably. But I think Python, like, interpreted languages and stuff are really good starting point, especially for young kids. You don't need to teach them about memory management. They can learn that as they go along.
I think so too, but it's again, you have this difference between this traditional approach of how you learn something and why you think you're better for it and why you're afraid that kids are going to learn something in a backwards way, and you're gonna be missing a lot of foundational. Like, you mentioned how, I think I mentioned as well, my little cousin, she uses the iPad all the time.
Yeah.
But she has no idea how to use a desktop computer.
Yeah.
Because she has no interest in it. She wasn't raised on it. And mm-hmm. when you view them, like, these kids using these desktop computers, they are going to download all these weird toolbars and install all these viruses by accident.
Oh,
malware.
Yeah, my gosh. Because
they have no idea how to deal with any of this stuff, right? So that's, I think that's kind of like the same kind of analogy holds with programming. You're going to start to program stuff in a weird way, and you're going to be like, wait, why are you doing it this way?
But I think, so is there really that big of a, is the difference that big? So PC, I would say desktop computing and iPads are two totally different computing paradigms. In the way that you interact, the way that you understand files, the way that you accomplish goals, those are two totally separate things. And so my thought is, you look at, like, a Python program, and you look at a C program. What are the barriers? So what are the barriers between making a Python program the equivalent of a C program?
Well, you need to have
static typing.
Not just static typing. There's also memory management. There's also the types of, like, there's optimization. Like in Python, it might not matter if you type in, if you use a multiply function or a like multiply command, like, you know, star, whatever, A star B. Whereas in C, it would matter.
Yeah, although compilers are getting really, really good at sussing that stuff out.
They are, but I think, I mean, you're not going to know. I mean, it might not be relevant anymore, but at least a few years ago, it was very relevant.
And that's true. But would you say that that's a different paradigm of computing, or it's just like, okay, now that you've got the building blocks, now we're going to teach you like memory. Like, what's a memory? What's a memory table? Like, what's an address table? Like, and how do you, when you're creating these objects, what are you doing? Each time you create an object in Python, you're allocating memory, right? So Python takes care of that for you. Now that you're in C, if you create an object and you start running away, does that object go away?
Well, Python...
No, you gotta release it.
Right. And Python is always... It's passed by reference by default, right? Whereas in C, you aren't always going to pass by reference. You're going to be, like, really confused when you work with C and be like, wait a second, why aren't things working the way they're supposed to work? Whereas if you go the opposite way, you understand that, oh, Python's always passed by reference. I know what that means, and I know what to expect. So you'll know, you kind of know what functions you can and can't do. In terms of making you a slick programmer, it gives you a much greater potential of making you an amazing programmer, as opposed to just, like, writing easy, slick. I mean, if you want to build, like, write code that's simple and do simple things, like parse a file and, like, run a, a sum function on it or a mean function, yes, you can do that. But you can also do that in Excel.
Yeah, you can.
Like, all those basic functions that you mm-hmm. could learn to code for, you don't need to learn to code for. So I think, you know, all those people who are encouraging people to learn how to code, they're doing it, I think, because they want people to understand the world that they live in.
Yeah.
An API for everything.
Right. As opposed to, like, it being practical. Because otherwise, you don't – I mean, Excel can do quite a lot, man.
Yeah.
Like, it can do a whole bunch of stuff. And web apps are out there too to help people do things that are more specialized. But in terms of, most people don't need to learn to code. That's just my opinion. And I know to code because I have to know how to code because of mm-hmm. my job. But if I didn't have to, I don't think I would.
Yeah, I think there's a couple. So I think there's a couple things, a couple comments on that. I think that's true. I think not everyone needs to know how to program and needs to know how to code in order to be able to do things. Just like not everyone. So nowadays, like the research that I'm working on, not everyone needs to know how to, like, understand parallel computation or to deploy and manage resources. Right? How many of us today, like, I'm doing a bunch of stuff on AWS. Like, I know how to. I can physically build up a physical cluster, deploy it, and, like, run it. Right? Not a lot of, like, that's in a sense, unless you're working on big scale or whatever, special needs, that's like a dying art, right? There's not so many. They're not even teaching that as much in colleges anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't need to know how to, like, swap out power supplies and, like, check memory and things like that. Like, so not everyone needs to know how to do that in order to be, like, a good, like, the guys at Snapchat, their co-founders never owned a physical server, like, never touched one.
How much Perl do you know?
Not much at all.
Right. Perl was, like, the language that you needed to know. I mean, people say that Perl saved bioinformatics. And I'm just like, great. So I mean, how do I explain this? If you see a job out posting out there mm-hmm. for Perl, it's because they're trying to maintain some kind of legacy system that is important. But they just don't want to rewrite that code in Python or in something else. But it's in Perl, and they can't decipher it. It's magic. They don't want to touch it. They just want it to run, and they want you to be able to, like, edit a few things here and there and make it do
now,
what you want.
That's true. Now, continuing on the thread that I was trying to trace out is that there are things that not everyone needs to know, but there are also things in which the currency of the realm is computers, right? So in a sense, it's also like saying not everyone needs to know how to use a computer. Well, pretty much everybody needs to know how to use a computer. And the jobs of the future that are opening up are very much, we are a service sector, knowledge sector, like, industry moving forward. And that's especially what our country is moving towards. And that's arguable, but whatever. And so if you want people to be able to have the skills and the ability to do things in the future, you want them to be able to program. And so part of, I think, the issue that, that you and I are talking around is that both of us are already, both of us already swim in this world. And the world looks really defined to us. And so the question is, how do we best, and there's maybe there's some areas that we haven't really explored, or the question of how do you, like, so how would you best go and explore, like, if somebody's in the pool, how do you help them to go best swim through all of the, all the edges and corners of the pool? Like, how would you best help someone explore this? But the issue is that there's lots of people that aren't even in the pool yet. They're just standing on the outside. And the pool looks really scary to them, right? You remember the first time that you went off a diving board? Mm-hmm. And you're like, you're just for sure that you're going to die. Right? Like, just for sure. Or the first time that you get, that you, like, get in the water. And you're just like, or the ocean. You're just like, it's terrifying, right? It's this thing that you don't even understand. And now looking back on it, it seems really silly, but those are very real fears that everybody faces, right? You go to the pool and you see the young kids getting in the water for the first time or something like that. So the question that, that I think the question that BASIC was trying to answer, and the question that projects like Code Academy, and even Raspberry Pi, like this is what they're trying to do. The question is, how do we get people in the water? What's the easiest way to do that? And how do we get them into the water early, right? That people that grew up, they talk about those kids, you know all those kids that like grew up in the water, right? Or grew up on the lake, or grew up in the ocean, and they just have a totally different experience and understanding of that world and that reality. And so the question is, how do we get kids into programming? And is the barrier to programming and to help them like to trade in the currency of the realm? If I can keep mixing metaphors. And so the question is memory management necessary for them to get in the water?
You know, it's not a tough concept to grasp. If you ask me, memory management, and it's just, it's beneficial to know it.
No, but if somebody's like getting, so it's a question of, if you want to get somebody in the water, or if you want to teach somebody to swim, what do you do first? Like, do you teach them the butterfly? Butterfly is a hard, like, swim stroke. It's not complicated for conceptually, but it's hard to, like, master and get going. Or do you teach them to just kind of, like, paddle around, or maybe just do the forward stroke or crawl, I don't remember even what it's called, like
and the stroke,
freestyle or something like that.
And the strokes here are languages, like
I think it could be languages, it could be concepts. I mean, the metaphor doesn't totally hold up, but the question is, what's the minimum necessary, or how do you get people in the water fast enough? What's the minimum necessary thing for you to teach them? And I would argue, and I think that it's not that those things are unnecessary, but I think that they're needlessly complicated to teaching somebody what is a program, what is the concept of the fact that you can do things with, that you can compute and manipulate ideas and numbers and sets of information.
So to extend your metaphor, I think the most apt analogy would be that learning just Python and without any kind of other knowledge is like learning the doggy paddle and learning maybe C and a bunch of other interesting algorithms and computer like specification stuff like memory management.
Mm-hmm.
That's more like learning how to freestyle. And if you want to get really good, you can go to college and then, you know, I don't know, maybe even get a PhD in computer science. And have you seen Tim Ferriss's video on how to learn to swim?
No.
So Tim Ferriss is, I'm sure you've heard that name before.
Yeah.
He's like the lifestyle guy. He basically had his whole video on how he didn't know how to swim at all as a kid and how he looked at Michael Phelps. And, you know, Phelps is a natural swimmer. But there was a guy from Japan who was the exact opposite of Phelps, and he came in second. So he was like, I want to know what this Japanese guy is doing. And he figured out his technique.
Mm-hmm.
And he learned that when he swims, like he sucks in tons of air, so that way his chest fills up with air, which makes him more buoyant in the water. And then when he strokes, like he basically slices the water and not stroke through it.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the power comes from the hips.
Yeah.
And those techniques, it's like learning memory management or learning pointers or references. And with that, you have so much more power. Like it's the difference between taking 3 hours to go from one end of the pool to the other with, you know, and being dead tired in a doggy paddle versus just like slicing through the water and getting to the other end in a matter of a few minutes. So, that's the point.
That is really true. And so I think I'm excited for saying, I think we have a lot to learn on how we teach people how to do stuff like that, on how we not only get them in the pool and get them away from that fear, but then we also say, now we're going to get you to swim fast.
If everyone needs to get in the pool, yeah, go ahead. Give them all floaties, and we'll get them
paddle
across.
Around there.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll get them across. You know, but if it doesn't take much to learn, then why not?
Yeah. There you go. All righty. Well, I think that's it.
Yeah, Rick, we're right. You're out of time here.
Yeah, that was a perfect end right there. That was really great. So, all right. Well, folks, thank you for joining us for another week. And make sure you follow us on Twitter at Informatonauts. I am at Nick Robison.
And I'm at Nikhil Gopal.
All right. We look forward to hearing from you. And, if you've got any thoughts on especially this idea of teaching, does everybody need to program? How do you teach people to program? Maybe stories of how you got into where you are. I think we'd love to hear that. It'd be really interesting to hear other people's experiences, especially maybe some folks that maybe program but don't do that like full time for their jobs. That might be interesting to hear your perspective on that.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot, guys.